Welcome to The Truth About Cancer, A Global Quest. I'm your host, Ty Bollinger. Now, many of you may have seen the quest for the cures last year. We were able to travel across the United States interviewing doctors, scientists, researchers, and cancer patients to learn what they were doing to treat cancer. It's only because of your support that we have been able this year to travel across the globe and to do over 100 new interviews with top scientists, researchers, doctors, and cancer patients that are preventing, treating, and beating cancer. What you just saw represents less than half of the total interviews that you will see over the next 9 days.
Why set out on a quest across the globe in search of the true cures to cancer? You may ask, why would I be so set on finding cancer's true preventions and treatments? Did you know that almost 50% of the people alive today will face cancer? Did you know that 1 in 4 males alive today will die from cancer and 1 in 5 females will die from cancer? While these statistics give enough reason for many good people to search out the answers, they are not the central reason that triggered my journey across the globe in search of the true answers for cancer. Let me tell you why I had to embark on this journey. For me, everything began with an irreplaceable loss. It's an old wound beginning 20 years ago, but sometimes it still feels like it just happened yesterday. I lost both my mother and my father to cancer. Well, in all actuality, it was actually to cancer's false treatments. I also lost 5 other close family members to cancer and its so-called treatments. After my folks died, I was angry and paralyzed by grief. I couldn't see any good coming out of what had happened to them, and I felt like their lives were wasted, and Charlene, my wife, and our children were robbed of precious future memories. But it was in the moment that the first book I wrote about cancer's treatments got into the hands of someone seeking the life-saving information on cancer that everything changed. I then realized for the first time that my parents' life and deaths actually mattered. Just last year, everything we learned culminated in the quest for the cures. Fast forward to The Truth About Cancer, A Global Quest. I knew that this endeavor would take more energy, research time, and more tears than anything Charlene and I had ever done before. Again, it was difficult to leave my precious wife and children, and at times I questioned whether it was worth the sacrifice to take this quest around the globe, but Charlene was the first one to tell me that I had to go. I truly owe this entire mission to my precious wife. She was my hope when I'd given up. She was my faith when I was barely holding on, and she was a gift from heaven, and she still is. Oh, and a word about my children. A rule that I learned as a father, never leave your kids out. Our eldest, Brianna, is a diligent worker and adventurous. She loves her animals, the outdoors, and brandishing her pocket knife skills. Bryce has a hysterical sense of humor, a high set of values, respects his elders, and he loves sports like basketball. Then there's Tabitha with her comical laughter, her gentle care for her little sister, and her love for animals and dressing up like a princess. And finally, our youngest, Charity, who loves nothing more than clinging to mommy and daddy and playing with her big sissy, Tabitha. Having these precious children and a wonderful wife has taught me that life is worth fighting for. So it was time for me to embark on this journey, venturing into the areas of the world with more equipment than we can handle, with a chance of getting stopped by authorities, which actually happened more than once, having equipment failure or challenges to health or safety for the team and myself. But the bigger personal challenge for me was knowing each day that I would be revisiting the loss of my mother and father and the things that I could have done if I had known about them earlier that would have saved their lives. And yet, it is this pain that pushes me further. Dad's my hero. He would be proud of what we're doing. Of that, I'm sure. You are about to learn the best treatments and preventions to cancer, protocols that won't harm your body, from the world-leading doctors across the globe. You'll see and experience things you wouldn't have even believed had you not watched each of these 9 episodes and seen the science and documented evidence to support the countless people that are living witnesses that there are true answers to the dreaded disease of cancer. Get ready for one of the most transformational experiences of your life as we journey into a 9-day quest to find the true answers for cancer. This is The Truth About Cancer, a global quest.
We travel the entire globe to gather this life-saving information so that we can empower you with knowledge. Please tell your friends and family to tune in for the next 9 days. This information is of vital importance. Dr. Ivars Kalvins, one of the 2015 finalists for the European Medicine Award, explains why.
It is calculated that the new generation, the generation of today, from this generation, each second man and each third woman will have this illness, the cancer.
1 in 2 men and 1 in 3 women that are alive today are going to face cancer. That's why we at The Truth About Cancer are so passionate about our mission to educate, expose, and eradicate cancer once and for all. In order for us to educate, we felt that it was vitally important that we obtain the most cutting-edge information about cancer preventions and treatments, and that's why we traveled across the globe and we obtained interviews with over 100 new experts representing over 20 different countries. A big portion of educating people about the truth is exposing the lies, and that's why, specifically in this episode 1, we are going to be exposing the lies about the history of modern medicine and the history of cancer treatments. So after the next 9 days of educating you about the truth and exposing the lies, together we will be one step closer to eradicating cancer once and for all. But let me ask you a question. Can someone educate someone else about something that they know nothing about?
They gave us a whole hour on nutritionals. A whole hour. In 4 years of medical school. Mm-hmm. And they told us there's vitamin A and B1 and B2 and C and D, and they're in alphabetical order, and you can look them up. And then they told us some really basic facts. We got a whole hour.
First of all, how much training did you receive on nutrition when you were in medical school? Because I know here in the States, it's almost none.
Yeah, not much.
Not much?
Not much.
Even in Argentina?
It's close to, yeah. Yeah, very little.
Close to none?
Very little.
Because you know, in medical school, they don't teach you anything about nutrition.
It's so vitally important for us to understand this history if we're going to answer that question, why is modern medicine so drug intensive? And it's not because patent petrochemical medicine is superior. It's because of monopoly medicine, which was created over 100 years ago. The word doctor actually means teacher, and so doctors should be educating their patients and teaching their patients. But unfortunately, the only thing that doctors are taught while they're in medical school is how to prescribe drugs.
We got hours and hours and hours on how to use basically patent medicines, which, as you know, are what usually goes on the prescription pad as a molecule that can be patented, which means it's not found in nature. Because you can't patent it if it's not found in nature. And that's what we get educated in.
They don't get paid to educate people. They get paid to write prescriptions. And you know, you can imagine the drug lobby made sure that's the case.
The doctor is brainwashed when he gets out of medical school because the medical school has too much subsidization of the professors who are being paid by the drug company. So the professor never teaches any student in medical school, why don't you try vitamin C? They're going to tell him the latest drug.
And that's by design, specifically. You know, there about over a century ago, there's foundations, the Carnegie and the Rockefeller foundations, who sort of engineered the curriculum through their grants and donations.
Are you wondering what Dr. McCullough meant when he mentioned that the Carnegies and the Rockefeller foundations engineered medical school curriculum over a century ago? He was referring to the Flexner Report of 1910, which we covered in our last documentary.
Just in case you missed that important piece of this foundation that we're laying today, here's a brief recap.
You see, if we're going to change where we're going, we need to know where we've been. And that's why history is so important. Because as the old saying goes, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it.
So I don't need to go any further. You can understand when the money is coming from a source which has a vested interest in the outcome. Now, what's going to happen is the outcome is going to be what the donor wants it to be, generally. So this is the problem. And that goes back even further in time to the turn of the last century. when the Rockefeller group and the Carnegie group actually came together, and they decided that they would reform medical education in America.
At the time of the late 1800s and early 1900s, 20th century, medical schools taught a lot of different things. There were homeopathic medical schools, there were naturopathic schools, there were eclectic herbal type medicine schools, and so it was all there. There was not one way. And what happened was that the Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundations were interested in establishing the one way. How would they do that? Well, they would get a hold of the education system and create a medical monopoly via basically eliminating all competition to patent petrochemical medical education. That's the Flexner Report of 1910, it became known. Abraham and Simon Flexner, you know, were hired to do this. It was a preordained commissioned report.
Not surprisingly, the basis of the report was that it was far too easy to start a medical school and that most schools we're not teaching sound medicine. Let me translate this for you. These natural health colleges were not pushing enough chemical drugs manufactured by who? Carnegie and Rockefeller. The AMA, who were evaluating the various medical colleges, made it their job to target and shut down the larger respected homeopathic colleges. Carnegie and Rockefeller began to immediately shower hundreds of millions of dollars on these medical schools that were teaching drug-intensive medicine.
Oh, by the way, when they donated the money, the donors would say, well, now we've given you a lot of money and we know you're going to do the right thing with it, but would you object if we had someone from our staff appointed to your board of directors, just to make sure that just to see how our money is being spent, you know? Well, that was really a condition of getting the money. So you know the university said, well, that would be fine. Anybody that you would suggest would be, I'm sure, more than adequate. So they began to load up the boards of directors of these teaching centers with people who literally were on the payroll of the donors. So once that was in place, the curriculum of the universities, the teaching centers, swung completely in the direction of pharmaceutical drugs, and it has remained that way ever since.
Predictably, those schools that had the financing churned out the better doctors. Oh, wait a minute, or should I say, the more recognized doctors. In return for the financing, the schools were required to continue teaching course material that was exclusively drug-oriented, with no emphasis on natural medicine. By 1925, over 10,000 herbalists were out of business. By 1940, over 1,500 chiropractors would be prosecuted for practicing quackery. The 22 homeopathic medical schools that flourished in the 1900s dwindled down to just two by 1923. By 1950, all the schools teaching homeopathy were closed. In the end, if a physician did not graduate from a Flexner-approved medical school and receive an MD degree, then he or she could not find a job anywhere. This is why today MDs are so heavily biased towards synthetic drug therapy and know little about nutrition, if anything.
Now this whole medical field has been skewed in the direction of pharmaceutical drugs, which can be patented and produce great profits for the producers. And then the next step is that means that anything coming from nature is excluded. Mm-hmm. And that's where we think, some of us think, that most of the promise lies in these very complex substances found in herbs and plants and trees and things like that, seeds. Some of us feel that it was probably meant to be that way, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you come out of all of this analysis and all of this history with the realization that the medical profession is really like a lapdog of the pharmaceutical industry. Mm-hmm. And most of the doctors have no idea that that's the case. They don't understand this history.
It's so vitally important for us to understand this history if we're going to answer that question, why is modern medicine so drug intensive? And it's not because patent petrochemical medicine is superior. It's because of monopoly medicine, which was created over 100 years ago.
And the other aspect is also monopoly on treatment. only pharmaceutical conventional medicine is the medicine that is officially approved and acclaimed, and people who try to find other solutions are have difficulties when it comes to insurance coverage and other problems. So maintaining monopoly on treatment is also one of the way to protect and grow this business.
And have you noticed that when a new drug comes out and they call it a blockbuster drug, they're not talking about it cures cancer. They're not talking about it's blockbuster for health. They're talking about how many bucks you can make. And that's what it always is. It seems that the number one goal of a lot of healthcare is to make money. And if we happen to do some good with it, that's fine. But our number one goal is to make money.
Very few know that the birth hour of the pharmaceutical industry is actually a deliberate decision by a handful of people on this side and on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean to define disease as a marketplace and build what has now become the largest investment industry upon that simple thought. So cancer is just one element of this unspeakable business of defining diseases as a marketplace. Everything else that you see today around the pharmaceutical industry, the tremendous profits, the inability to eliminate diseases, the propaganda war from that side that they are actually making progress in any disease, all of that comes from the fact that it's a business model, an investment industry that thrives on the continuation of existing diseases and the launching of new diseases.
Yes, modern medicine is a business. And just like any business, the goal is to grow this business and also to eliminate competition and to maintain the monopoly. I mean, heck, even in 1913, the American Medical Association developed an internal department that they called the Propaganda Department, and its main goal was to eliminate quacks. But what exactly is quackery? I mean, in the United States, our first president, George Washington, he died as a result of bloodletting, and that was an approved treatment of the day. Ignaz Semmelweis was called a quack because he suggested that doctors actually wash their hands before surgery.
And physicians today that do not use chemotherapy, they're considered to be quacks. But very few people know the real history of chemotherapy and its origins.
How we first discovered chemotherapy, the first chemotherapy agents in the early 1940s, was because in Italy, when they dropped nitrogen mustard gas, okay, and it was in, you know, one of these missions and all, and they were doing the post-mortem autopsies on the body, the lymphocytes of these patients dropped down. And then some of these doctors got an idea, well, guys, someone has leukemia or lymphoma where these lymphocytes are producing too much. It was suppressed in these people that were dropped with mustard gas. So the chemotherapy agent comes from the history of actually making
mustard gas.
You said it.
As shocking as this may be, the first chemotherapy agents and even some of the agents that are still used today are derived from the mustard gases that were used to kill soldiers in the world wars. I mean, this explains why many people, including myself, would never touch chemotherapy. It's just too darn toxic. But it's not just me. As you're about to learn, and we learned from a previous interview, 90% of oncologists, they won't do chemo either.
There's a study that came out about 90% of physicians, particularly in oncology, would not prescribe the drug that they give to their patients to their wife or their child. Right? So what does that tell us?
He's probably not going to do his treatment. Why would you?
In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared a war on cancer, but are we really winning this war in light of the fact that 90% of oncologists won't even take their own treatment? Is the cancer industry any closer today than they were then in finding a cure? Why does this perpetual war on cancer continue?
And one of the reasons why this war continues is the money that are being made in this war. And this refers to the treatments, so-called treatments, that are being used in cancer, namely chemotherapy and radiation. Chemotherapy uses the most powerful toxins known to humans. And these toxins, of course, are being sold to us as substances that can kill cancer cells. But these substances also kill, annihilate healthy cells in the body, damage its organs, which make the recovery from cancer almost a miracle, impossible. And also this, the very substances that are being used to fight cancer are cancer-causing chemicals. So instead of eliminating cancer or curbing cancer, we are inducing, generating new cancers.
That's pretty interesting, isn't it? So maybe one of the reasons that 90%+ of oncologists won't do conventional treatments like chemotherapy is that they actually cause cancer. Let's listen to Dr. Véronique Desaulniers, who actually cured her own mother and herself of breast cancer, talk about tamoxifen, which is the most popular drug prescribed to treat breast cancer.
Tamoxifen is a drug that most women are put on when they have breast cancer, but they don't tell them that it's classified as a carcinogen by the American Cancer Society and the World Health Organization. So does it make sense to give women a carcinogenic drug that will cause cancers in other parts of her body to prevent cancer?
Wow, that's really shocking, isn't it? Tamoxifen, the number one drug prescribed to treat breast cancer, it actually causes cancer. What about other chemotherapy drugs? Is tamoxifen alone?
It's estimated by 2020 that more than half of all cancer in America will be medically induced from drugs or radiation. So our medical establishment itself will soon become the leading cause of cancer in America.
It's not the cancer that really hurts people. Okay, statistically, 42 to 46% of patients will die that have cancer will die of cachexia, which is basically wasting of protein. They basically lose all their lean body mass. So that leaves between 58 and 54% of patients that didn't die of cachexia. And the joke, which is only maybe half funny, is that the rest of them die from the treatment. In other words, really nobody dies from the cancer. If you think about it, when a patient gets immunosuppressed and they have cancer, what actually takes them? Liver failure, kidney failure, pneumonia, sepsis. But all these things are usually associated with also the person getting chemo and radiation.
Then went into practice in San Francisco as an oncologist with a group of oncologists. And I began to notice that my long-term survivor list was pretty short. And I began reading the literature that everyone was, that after 5 years of chemo, in their own literature, they recorded only a 2.1% survival rate.
We know that 97% of people who undergo chemotherapy are dead in 5 years. That study was placed in the 2004 edition of the Journal of Oncology. It was the cancer doctors telling on themselves. Do I know this study to be true? It was a massive study done by epidemiologists who themselves were doctors. I interviewed the lead of that study just within the last 6 months. And I said, is this still true today? This was published in 2004. And he says, it's absolutely as true today as it was when we published it back in 2004, and it may be getting worse. When they tell us that chemo's our only chance, it's the first lie you hear. And then you have the surgery. The second lie is we got it all. You can't get it all if you're focused on tumors. You simply can't. Cancer's probably already metastatic. Surgery spills it. Radiation proven not to kill the stem cells, but to enhance them. Well, we always hear, well, cancer came back. Didn't come back, folks. It just never left.
But chemotherapy is not only incredibly ineffective, it's also hazardous material.
Let's look at chemotherapy, for example. Chemotherapy, yes, it can kill cancer cells. Possibly. It can kill any cell. Here's the issue that I have with chemotherapy. When I see somebody that's handling chemotherapy, making chemotherapy, and they have to wear hazmat suits and gloves and, you know, can't touch it because it's toxic, then why are you going to give it to a person who's already sick? I mean, does it make any sense? You ask a three-year-old child this question, I would bet you that 90% of the three-year-old children would get it. If that looks dangerous, then I shouldn't touch it. That's it. It's almost like sending in napalm because you've got an ant problem. So yes, you'll take care of the ants, possibly, but then you're going to take care of every other form of life, including the grass, and you're going to level the site just to try to get the ants. So the collateral damage are the people that live there in the same house as the ants, meaning that the normal, endogenous, healthy cells are also going to get massacred. Just from a common sense standpoint, does it make any sense to take a therapy, let's use radiation as an example, to take a therapy that we know is dangerous under any circumstance. You break your leg, you break your hand, you go to the hospital, they take you in to get an x-ray, they've got the skull and crossbones, they've got the universal triangular radiation sign as a warning. Why is there a warning there? You tell me.
Because it's known that it's harmful.
And how is it harmful?
It damages DNA.
It damages DNA, and what is this consequence of damaging that DNA?
Potentially cancer.
Bingo. So then why would we take something that we know has a very high propensity to create cancer and use that to treat cancer?
It does seem insane to treat cancer with chemotherapy and radiation that actually cause cancer, doesn't it? But doctors are required to do this. As a matter of fact, they suffer adverse consequences if they do not prescribe chemo and radiation. They can even lose their license to practice medicine.
There was one good doctor who was allowing some natural treatments when parents were asking to introduce them, but he could not offer it himself. And when I asked him, he said, I couldn't do it, I will lose my job. So it means oncologists here and many other countries, I'm sure, they're very restricted in protocols. So they're not free to offer a good treatment. They're very restricted in their protocols.
There are many physicians who are truly authentically motivated to want to help people, but there is this pervasive fear that they are going to be discredited and ostracized in their own community. And when they start to embrace some of these alternative philosophies. So that's a strategy that's used to suppress this type of information. When you've got tens of billion dollars of revenue, there is no limit to the clever and sophisticated techniques that you can acquire to manipulate the masses.
It's against law in California for oncologists to recommend integrative.
Is it really?
They cannot tell you go do integrative medicine.
So unfortunately, doctors in America, Australia, the UK, they can risk losing their medical license if they recommend anything other than the gold standard, which is chemotherapy and radiotherapy. In my mind, those treatments are substandard. So we know that chemotherapy and radiotherapy cause cancer, which is the very thing they're supposed to prevent. I mean, you look on the back of certain chemotherapy drugs like doxorubicin, and you'll see a listed side effect is leukemia.
And doxorubicin's a pretty popular
Yeah, drug. Absolutely. And you know as well as I do that the latest research from Harvard Medical School and UCLA is showing that chemotherapy actually stimulates cancer stem cells, which are the germ cells from which new tumors arise.
Investigative journalist Laura Bond just mentioned the fact that chemotherapy stimulates cancer stem cells. But what's a stem cell, and what does this have to do with cancer?
So what is a cancer cell, and where does it come from?
Well, we used to think that any cell could become cancer, except for a few limited ones. We thought that if you irritate a cell enough and damage its DNA enough, it'll become immortal and just keep growing. Now we find out, well, that's not true. Only stem cells seem to be the source of cancers. And stem cells are cells that haven't decided what they want to be yet. They're very primitive cells, so they can be anything. Be a heart cell, a brain cell, lung cell. And so these stem cells are all through your body, just sitting quietly. But if you damage the DNA of the stem cell enough through free radicals or whatever, it'll become immortal. And then it just keeps producing more and more cells. It wakes up and it's producing lots and lots, thousands, millions, billions of cells. And it becomes a cancer. But it's the stem cell that's pouring it out, kind of like a water hose. It's pouring all these droplets of water out. The trouble with chemotherapy and conventional treatments is they have no effect on the cancer stem cell. They only kill the daughter cells, the cells that are produced by it. So the tumor will shrink, and they'll claim success, but you haven't killed the stem cell, so it all just comes right back. And what they found is when it comes back infinitely more aggressive than it did before.
And why would that be?
It's kind of complex chemistry, but it has to do with the chemical changes in what we call the microenvironment of the stem cell. And what you're doing, you're producing a lot of cytokines around those stem cells. These are inflammatory chemicals. Those inflammatory chemicals produce even greater DNA damage. So the cancer that comes back is more malignant than the one that started. So what they're finding is when you treat patients with chemotherapy and radiation and you don't cure them, then you make the cancer infinitely more aggressive and the patients usually die quicker. You have a room full of oncologists listening to the latest drug and they'll say, oh, this one, we're getting incredible responses with this drug. Well, as I explained, what happens with that incredible response, it causes dramatic shrinkage of the tumor initially because it's just killing the daughter cell. And some are not even non-malignant cell, but it's not affecting the stem cell. Mm. And so then the cancer grows tremendously, but they can say, oh, we get a good response from this chemotherapeutic agent.
And when they say good response, they mean the tumor shrunk.
They mean initially it shrinks the tumor, but they don't say, well, 6 months later or less, it actually is going to grow a lot faster.
Right.
And it's more likely to metastasize.
One of the problems with chemo is because when your patient do chemo, those circulating tumor cell, cancer cell that we have, once you have the primary tumor, they can mutate and they become more resistant to other treatments.
Sayer, talk to us today about chemo and radiation resistance.
Okay, great. I feel the word itself is almost like a euphemism for something really terrible, which is that when you are exposed to radiation that's based on gamma radiation, it's basically ionizing, it will cause damage to whatever basic tissue it's being exposed to. So in the same way, chemotherapy is also designed to be genotoxic. So you're trying to target fast replicating cells. And so by doing so, it is by definition also carcinogenic. And so really when we talk about resistance to chemo radiation, it's really just a way of blaming the victim, because we're all, when exposed to conventional chemo and radiation, going to be harmed, and it is actually going to have a carcinogenic effect, and it will often cause secondary cancers. So technically, I think people need to be aware that this isn't truly a cancer therapy. At best, it's palliative in the sense that it might shrink a tumor, but what really the main thing I would like to get across is that it's going to cause an enrichment of the actual mother cell that's beneath the tumor, which is known as the cancer stem cell. So technically you are shrinking the tumor size, but you're enriching the population of the tumorigenic cells at the very same moment. So again, the idea that some people are resistant to chemo and radiation is really a false concept. Everyone exposed to radiation and chemo will have secondary adverse effects, some of which are worse than the original condition they're being treated for.
So stem cells are the key, and chemotherapy and radiation actually enrich stem cells. Now, we will get back to this topic a little bit later on, but that last statement from Sayer G really shook me. Everyone will have secondary adverse effects from chemo and radiation. Despite this fact, as we've already learned, many doctors from countries across the globe might even lose their license if they do not prescribe chemo and radiation. Are you beginning to see the way that Big Pharma has its tentacles throughout this medical cartel, especially when it comes to chemotherapy? But that's not all. Chemotherapy also creates side effects that can then be treated with more drugs. Let's listen to Dr. Alexander Nitzwicki elaborate on this issue.
Chemotherapy business is also a wonderful example of multiplicator because the side effects that chemotherapy produces is bone marrow transplants. This is the results of chemotherapy, bleeding from the intestines, that requires drug, anti-nausea drugs, and many others, changes in the brain. There is even term for it, it's called chemo brain, because the chemotherapy affects, you know, so many organs in the body, and it's the reason for prescribing more drugs. So chemotherapy multiplies the business, and this is why it lasts until this day.
Chemotherapy destroys your army, it destroys your immune system. Mm. Not only that, it causes secondary cancers in the body, it makes existing cancer stem cells more aggressive, and it causes a host of lifelong, potentially lifelong, damages to the body, from brain damage to hearing loss to neuropathy with loss of the use of your hands and feet to kidney and bladder damage, I mean, bone damage, heart damage, lung damage. Mm-hmm. It's just total collateral damage from chemotherapy.
We didn't know 50 or 60 years ago the role that the immune system played like we did today, because we didn't have the technology to measure it and identify it. But today, a person who's paying attention will see more and more medical articles. They'll see more and more stuff come out on the investigative news shows talking about breakthroughs in immunotherapy.
Right.
And how they are, in fact, tapping and harnessing the immune system to ferret out cancer and kill it in a very specific manner instead of this global, you know, napalming of the body with chemo and radiation, which, you know, I don't know that it's ever been successful at any level except to provide more money for you know, the administration and I guess the folks that are coming up with that. I mean, if the money had been poured into immunotherapy over the last 50 years,
right,
as it has been these other attempts that ended up failing, I'd have to believe that the results would be a whole lot better than, certainly been a lot less suffering. I think anybody who has met or been close to someone undergoing chemo and radiation will admit that it is a suffering instead of a treatment.
In order for having a maximum chance of fighting and overcoming cancer, we need an intact immune system. And that too makes the current approach of chemotherapy so unethical. It destroys the chemotherapy, the first organ that is affected, actually the target organ is the bone marrow. The destruction of the generation of defense cells, leukocytes, etc., are built in the bone marrow. So from the very onset, from the very planning of chemotherapy, from the very scientific approach, it is a deception. It is an unethical, deceptive business that creates illusions for millions of people. And everyone, every scientist involved in it, I'm not blaming the doctors. They sometimes don't have the education to go at that length. But every scientist knows that it is a huge fraud. And those who say they don't, they should quit the job of being a scientist.
I appreciate what Dr. Rath just said. The doctors, they're not educated about this. They don't understand that chemotherapy is a huge fraud. But that every scientist that doesn't understand and admit that chemotherapy is a huge fraud, they should quit the job of being a scientist. Now, Dr. Rath and A.J. Lanigan, an immunologist, just both addressed the same topic, that the immune system is the key to fighting cancer and to health. And one of the interesting things about chemotherapy is that it totally destroys and devastates the immune system. Another unique thing about chemotherapy that many people don't know is that oncologists can actually make kickbacks from prescribing chemotherapy drugs. This is a unique characteristic to the cancer industry that does not apply anywhere else in pharmaceutical drugs.
Business, you know, it's over $127 billion that is being spent on cancer care. Majority of that is in the pharmaceutical drug cost of the care. The average patient now, according to a study that came out by Kaiser Health, last year, was that they spend between $10,000 a month and $30,000 a month. So it's $10,000 to $30,000 just for the chemotherapy agents that they're using. And this price keeps on going up higher and higher. So that the average person has, say, 3 to 4 months of treatment. Some people have continuously ongoing treatments. So they kind of suppress the cancer, but we're not curing the cancer, for example. Then that can go up to 12 months or more. Okay, almost they keep coming back. You know, for tune-ups, they would say. So what most people don't realize is that in cancer treatments, that the facility, or more importantly, the physician that is then prescribing some of these medications, say if a person is a Medicare patient, the government allows the physician to charge the cost of the drug plus a percentage. So Medicare, for example, gives 6%, okay, on the cost of a drug as a reimbursement for, you know, de facto aspects of, you know, overhead costs, whatever it was. So what happens is if I was a physician and I was in that system, for example, I would prescribe a $100 drug, I'd get $6 back. Now, if I prescribe a $10,000 drug, I get $600 back, right? So
In other realms, that would be called a kickback. But in this realm, since it's legal,
it's reimbursement.
It's a reimbursement.
Right?
Okay.
Okay. The thing is, this is the only field, okay, in oncological care that gets that type of reimbursement.
Oncology is an unbelievably lucrative field of medicine, especially when you're running the business side of it.
Oncology is an incredibly lucrative business, and maybe it's because of this fact that we see stories like the story of Dr. Fareed Fattah in Michigan. He was an oncologist that over the last several years, he who was recently convicted of prescribing chemotherapy drugs to patients that didn't need it, many of whom didn't even have cancer, and sadly, many of whom died from the chemotherapy.
You know, when I hear about this guy, you start thinking about Charles Manson, you start thinking about Ted Bundy, you start thinking about Adolf Hitler or Stalin or any of the, you know, many, many people that have hurt large groups of people, you know, mass murderers, rapists, whatever you want to call them, people that are tyrannical. But, you know, this guy in one sense is worse than, say, Adolf Hitler, because at least if you were a victim of Adolf Hitler, you knew when the SS was coming, or you knew when Adolf Hitler was coming, you know, you better run. Or if you're one African tribe attacking another African tribe, when the guys are coming down the road with the, you know, machine guns, you know to run. But, you know, in this case, you're trusting this person with your life. I mean, you're going to him asking for help. And even in cases where people really did have cancer, he was inappropriately continuing to administer chemotherapy to them when they didn't need it, or even worse, or just as bad or worse, giving chemotherapy to people who simply didn't even have cancer. I mean, that's, to me, that's just unbelievable. I mean, it really is mind-boggling that someone could be that evil and that greedy.
He's been sentenced, I believe, to 45 years in prison.
Yeah.
But the most disturbing thing about this is not that he was caught and that he has been sentenced to prison. The disturbing thing is that there are hundreds of other cancer doctors out there doing the same thing, and they haven't been caught. And they get away with so much deception, violating medical ethics, lying to patients. Most patients never question their doctors because they think the doctor is the sole authority. Most patients don't even get a second opinion. Most patients believe the explanations, the diagnoses that the cancer doctors give them. Oh, this shadow on this x-ray, that means you have cancer. We have to start now or you're going to die. You know, the fear tactics that these oncologists use are highly unethical and really should be criminal. It is completely unacceptable that oncologists profit from the treatments that are justified by their own diagnosis. It's kind of like taking your car to a greasy mechanic somewhere that's not very honest, and he says, well, yeah, your carburetor needs to be replaced, or your car is going to blow up down the road. But he's just making that up because he wants the business. And if you believe him, then you're going to have to pay all this money for a procedure that your car didn't need. Same thing happens in the cancer industry every day in America.
I agree with Mike Adams. As he just mentioned, we must question our doctors. We cannot place blind faith in them. We must be educated. And that's why we are on this mission with The Truth About Cancer, to educate you on these issues. Why are we addressing chemotherapy at such length? Because you must know the history of chemotherapy. You must be informed about the dangers of chemotherapy if you're going to make an informed decision. Knowledge is power, and people are dying because they don't have this knowledge. It seems to me that the FDA in the United States and the TGA in Australia and other regulatory bodies across the globe should be actually protecting us from chemotherapy drugs and other toxic substances. Burton Goldberg, the voice of alternative medicine, gave us this telling quote.
The agencies that were designed to protect humanity are protecting the industry they're supposed to protect us from.
Well, any drug that is on the market available through prescription that has serious and widespread adverse effects, as they say, was previously declared safe and effective by the FDA. That's the only reason that drug reached the market. So if after approval it suddenly has opposite effects, very dangerous, that's fraud. Fraud at the level of the FDA for not investigating the drug properly or concealing the truth.
And the FDA, on its own website, openly admits that 100,000 plus people die each and every year from properly prescribed prescription drugs. What does this mean, the term properly prescribed prescription drugs? This means, according to John Rappaport, these are drugs that were previously declared to be safe and effective. But what does it mean to be declared safe and effective? What is the drug approval process that would declare a drug safe and effective?
The real interesting thing, Ty, is that what they do is drug companies pour literally $1 billion into the research needed to get FDA drug approval. So that starts with finding lead compounds to produce a synthetic chemical that then they go through phase 1, 2, 3 human trials with. But when they do this, they pour inadvertently $1 billion or more, all of these drug companies, into looking at turmeric, resveratrol, green tea, and literally thousands of compounds, and they find all this research showing it's superior to chemotherapy. And so those studies are there, and people don't know about them, but they also can't expect those studies on things you grow in your backyard that cure cancer to receive $1 billion of capital, because the whole game is based on producing a synthetic analog to get a patent, to get FDA drug approval. And then, of course, more than 50% of FDA-approved drugs before the patent life expires get pulled off the market because of the devastation and death that they cause. So the whole system is rigged.
I would have to agree with Sayer G. The system is rigged. But oftentimes, so are the articles that would validate the safety and efficacy of a particular drug. Let's listen to Dr. Russell Blaylock as he describes the way that even doctors are duped with ghostwritten articles.
What happens sometimes, and in fact it's happening more often than we would like, and it's a lot of stuff being written by the people that look into medical journal articles, but these pharmaceutical companies will have written for them ghost articles, they call them. And what they'll do, they'll get this company that writes articles that looks just like beautiful medical articles, with all the graphs and charts and numbers and references, and they'll write this article without any authors for the study because they wrote it, and then they'll go to an oncologist that's very well known and they say, wouldn't you like to put your name on this article? And if you do, it's going to be in a very prestigious journal, New England Journal of Medicine or some oncology journal that's very prestigious. And so a lot of these people attempted because this puts their name even further out front. So they'll say, yeah, put my name on there. And so they'll put a string of names on the article who had nothing to do with writing it, had nothing to do with the study, and they'll end up in a very prestigious journal. Well, these journals they choose are the ones that affect how doctors behave, how they treat patients. So they'll read this article, not knowing it's a ghost article, and they said, gee, they've got tremendous responses, and there's hardly any complications. And so they'll order the drug, and they'll tell the patient the same thing they got out of that article. There's hardly any complications. Patients are doing very well, and it's a good chance that this could cure you.
And it's not an independent article.
It's not an independent article, and the doctor's been tricked, and the patient's been tricked.
Recently was a big scandal, but nobody really paid attention that the FDA approved, about 4 years ago, approved an antibiotic, because the data was submitted by a French company, but it turned out the study was never done.
Falsified completely.
Yeah, it wasn't even done.
Now, this next physician asked that we not show his face, but listen to what he has to say about the way that money has corrupted the drug approval process.
I was actually groomed to become a person in one of the most successful clinical trials companies in the country. They pick me for medical. It's like the firm, they pick you, they help you through, and then you're supposed to join them. That's what you're supposed to do. So like, great, I get the big, like, join the firm, get the big car, I get this. And then you start realizing, once you start looking at data and how we're manipulating data and this and that, and there's people behind these drugs, you know. But it's just like, but that's the standard now, right? So I can get any drug passed, I can get any study manipulated. It's a pay-to-play game. We sat in rooms where we had CEOs of the top companies come in and say, okay, this is what it is. FDA would say something like, it doesn't work. And then within an hour, we can have a phone call with like six different universities and statisticians, $30,000 each person to work on 2 hours of crunching numbers, flip the numbers, have three editorial reviews, and then in 3 months, perception of that has changed. It's the greatest and best miracle drug ever. Although they didn't ever sort of support it, but they make billions of dollars, and as long as we put a black box warning, everybody makes money. Most people think that, you know, our and the physician's no fault of their own. A lot of them are just doing what they're told. You know, but then, you know, we can go back in history and where we heard that, I'm just doing it now, it's following orders. That's not a good way to do it.
But falsifying research and producing toxic prescription drugs, that's only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to big pharma. Let's have a listen to Dr. Matthias Rath as he describes the way that three big pharma companies, Bayer, Hetch, and BASF, they were responsible directly for creating concentration camps of Birkenau and Auschwitz.
We were in Auschwitz because we have a friendship with some of the survivors that are still alive from that time. And it is, since you asked me this question, I may just spend a moment on something that is very little known about Auschwitz. We've been told in the history book it was a camp that was built to annihilate Jewish people and Slavic people and people that the Nazis didn't like in the conquered countries. But what made Auschwitz the mega death extermination camp was actually the decision by Bayer, Hoechst and BASF to build the largest industrial plant of wartime in Europe. It is called IG Auschwitz, a 100% subsidiary of Bayer, Hoechst and BASF. And the plant was 8 kilometers long, about 5 miles long, and 2 miles wide. So it's a giant industrial area. And the Birkenau concentration camp, the huge camp that was featured in Schindler's List in that movie, was a deliberate decision to supply slave labor for the construction of this industrial plant. So without the interest that we just touched upon that put profits over lives, Auschwitz would never have had this meaning. The decision of Wannsee, which was the decision by the Nazis to exterminate the Jewish people, was taken roughly 1 year after the decision of IG Farben to build this plant. So the Nazis used the death apparatus that was already existing because of the slave labor camp being in existence. The chimneys were burning. IG Farben was not taking care of the sick people. After 3 months on average, the people were emacerated. And so they were just put to the gas chamber and shut up in the chimney. So I used a few more sentences than normal to exemplify. If we are talking today that there is an industry among humanity that sacrifices millions of lives or puts them at risk for profit, we are sometimes, you included, being attacked as being out of this world, conspiracy people. Now, we turn around, we look at Auschwitz, we look at the industrial plant, we look at the concentration extermination plant being built, initially built, to serve as slave labor camp for that purpose. And we can say, they've done it before.
I'm literally speechless. Millions of Jews were annihilated during World War II, and those concentration camps were built by Big Pharma to provide slave labor. As Dr. Rath said, they've done it before, they'll do it again. We must understand that people's lives once again are being sacrificed for the almighty dollar. Did you learn this in history class? I certainly didn't. But please keep an open mind as we're approaching these subjects. We must understand history if we're going to understand the current state of modern medicine.
I'm a German. I didn't learn anything about that. I was 35 years old when I learned about Bayer, BASF, the largest pharmaceutical companies at that time, were actually building or responsible for the extermination camp at Auschwitz. And then I wanted to know more, and there was nothing. So we finally found in the archives of the U.S. In Washington, the U.S. National Library, the records of case number 6 of the Nuremberg War Crime Tribunals. We are told that this was only one tribunal against the main war criminals, but in fact there were 12. Number 6 was against Bayer, BASF and Hoechst at that time they were forming a cartel by the name of IG Farben. And that whole case lasted an entire year against 24 managers of these pharmaceutical and chemical companies. And it showed that they were largely financing the rise of the Nazis to power, that they supplied 100% of the raw materials so that the Nazis could lead their war, including 100% of the synthetic gasoline, rubber, 100% of the explosives. The report came to the conclusion, the U.S. prosecutor said, without IG Farben, World War II would not have been possible. In other words, we have to redefine history. Even if we talk about cancer today, we need to know those things, that these interests for expanding patented product markets worldwide, they were risking eventually, they were responsible for the death of 60 million people in World War II. And that shows you the dimension of the topic that we are talking about today. There's nothing, absolutely nothing, that these interests will not do if the profit is high enough, then and now.
Did you know that one of the 12 Nuremberg tribunals was actually against Big Pharma? World War II actually could never have happened without the involvement of big pharmaceutical companies, specifically IG Farben. Dr. Rath mentioned patents. The cancer industry, yes, it is an industry, it's part and parcel with the multinational pharmaceutical companies. And the way that multinational pharmaceutical companies make their money is through patents. Big Pharma patents drugs, and they call that medicine. But do patented molecules, this medicine that they've created, does this have a place in modern healthcare? Or I think maybe the bigger question is, can we, as mortal men, improve on nature?
Patent medicines do not belong in human bodies. And I know I keep saying patent medicines, and people aren't accustomed to that. They think of the 19th century. I'm sorry, but all the giant pharmaceutical companies are holders of patents for molecule after molecule after molecule. It's sort of like what belongs in the body, just sort of enough to do something, but enough to cause a lot of damage too. So if we're going to be as healthy as we can in the bodies we now have, we have to use only the substance and energy that belongs in the body. And it makes no sense using patent medications. Patents are wonderful for certain things, protection of intellectual property rights and so forth, but patents have no place in healthcare.
You can't patent nature, which is why we don't get a lot of money for research in plant medicine, but then they'll make a molecule that looks like the molecule from nature, and then a pharmaceutical company can own it, right? But that's not really the same animal.
You cannot take and isolate every chemical out of a plant and expect that plant to have the same healing powers. And this is why chemical cancer medicine fails 97% of the time. Whereas plant medicine, being holistic, is safer, it's more efficacious, in other words, it works better, it's more affordable, readily available, and you don't have to pay patent fees to Mother Nature.
Francis Bacon was the founder of the modern scientific principle. In 1600, he said, "Nature to be commanded must be obeyed." And what we're doing in modern medicine is saying, we don't care about the rules. We're going to change the rules. We know that you need vitamin D and sunshine, but we're going to say we can't patent that. So we're going to try and come up with a drug that bypasses all of those pathways. Nature to be commanded must be obeyed.
I love that quote from Dr. Quillen. Nature, in order to be commanded, must be obeyed. And I think that's where big pharmaceutical companies fail, because they try to take nature and maybe a molecule from nature and tweak it and change it, but then it never works as well as the original molecule. And why do they tweak it and change it? So that they can patent it. We've already seen about the greed in this patent medicine industry, this cancer industry. Remember earlier in the show, we talked about the war on cancer. I have a question for you. What if the real war on cancer was actually a turf war aimed at protecting these profits?
This is a total war. Texas Medical Board is going after my doctors, is going after my assistants. They're suing everybody because of using the treatment, which is non-conventional.
According to Dr. Brzezinski, the real war is actually being fought against doctors who dare to step outside the box and use any kind of non-conventional treatment that's not approved. Dr. Brzezinski has been persecuted heavily for decades. And another doctor that's been heavily persecuted is Dr. Jonathan Wright. His crime? Using natural medicine that was outside of the standard of care and was not an approved treatement.
And on May 6, 1992, they raided our clinic with guns drawn.
No kidding.
No kidding. Yes, they told the King County Sheriff that we were selling drugs, because remember, they call feces a drug, and so vitamins are drugs. Anything used for treatment is, according to them, a drug. Okay, we were selling drugs. So the King County Sheriff's Office was expecting drug dealers. And yeah, they raided with guns. One of them came in and stuck his gun within a few feet of the receptionist's face. And one thing, though, they didn't have jackboots. You've heard of the jackbooted thugs and all that. No, they had wore regular shoes.
Okay.
And even though they had guns, they wore regular shoes and kicked the doors in with their regular shoes. The doors were locked. You see, they had the raid shortly before 9 a.m. And how do we know they kicked the doors in? Because somebody was sitting outside in a wheelchair waiting for his appointment, and he saw these guys come and kick the doors in. Okay, they came in with guns. And what did they do? They herded all the employees into a corner of the reception area. Okay. And they proceeded to start seizing equipment and medical records and payroll records and banking records and everything. And they told the King County police it was because we were dealing drugs. So anyway, that's what they did. And let's see. They impaneled a grand jury. 18 months later, nothing. They impaneled a second grand jury. Another 18 months, nothing. No indictments. After the second grand jury failed to return any indictment, and the first one did too, they then announced to the newspapers, not to me, they didn't call me or my attorney, they announced to the newspapers they were closing the investigation. And both my attorney and me, we read about it in the newspaper.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Never got the patient records back, never got the banking records back. We had to reconstruct as best as we could on the banking records and the patient records. We just had to ask people to tell us what they told us before. But no, that never came back.
So Dr. Wright lost all of his patient records, and in the end, he was never convicted of anything. Now, this almost sounds like there is a conspiracy, doesn't it? Now, people, they're afraid to use that term conspiracy because people might think you're nuts. But what if I told you that the United States Senate concluded that there was a conspiracy to suppress natural cancer treatments? Would that matter to you?
Now, you know, people hear this and they may say, you know, this sounds conspiratorial, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've heard of the Fitzgerald Report, right?
I got a copy of some of the conclusions over here. Shall I read them to people?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Fitzgerald Report. Tell the viewers what the Fitzgerald Report was.
I'll tell them. Or you can tell them and I'll just read it.
You go ahead and tell them.
Okay, Fitzgerald Report was published in the Congressional Record, folks. The Congressional Record. Actually, it was an appendix to the Congressional Record. And Fitzgerald was an investigator for the Interstate Commerce Commission. Now, I'm going to read this because I got to read you the citations because people will otherwise think it is conspiracy theory. Okay. 1953, he was an investigator for the Interstate Commerce Commission, a senator whose grandson had been cured of cancer by natural means and had a lot of trouble getting that cure done, asked him to investigate. Now, here's just one quote. Fitzgerald says, quote, "My investigation to date should convince this committee that a conspiracy does exist." This is testimony before Congress by a chief investigator for the Interstate Commerce Commission. "A conspiracy does exist to stop the free flow and use of drugs." Now, he calls it all drugs because, I'm sorry, but most people in conventional medicine call even vitamins drugs. If it's a treatment, it's a drug. And you do know that FDA declared stool a drug some 2 years ago. And then they got so much ridicule from the academic centers that were doing these stool fecal transplants that they undeclared stool a drug. But for a while, feces was a drug. How do you like that? Okay. Anyway, back to Fitzgerald. I know. It just seems weird, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay. "To stop the free flow and use of drugs in interstate commerce, which allegedly have solid therapeutic value, public and private funds have been thrown around like confetti at a country fair to close up and destroy clinics." Notice he uses the word destroy. What he's talking about is the occasions when FDA went in with sledgehammers and broke up Royal Rife equipment in the office of Dr. Ruth Drown, where they made someone throw all of his books that he had written on one aspect of energetic medicine. They were all burned at a bonfire in New Jersey. Book burning! Sledgehammers! Yeah. Now, Fitzgerald didn't say that. You can find that other part. I'll go back to Fitzgerald. But that's what he means by destroy. That's why he used the word destroy. Okay, "to destroy clinics, hospitals, and scientific research laboratories which do not conform to the viewpoint of medical associations." Got nothing to do with the law. It's got to do with the viewpoint of medical associations. Benedict S. Fitzgerald, Junior Special Counsel, United States Committee on Interstate Forest Commerce, 1953. And his report goes into a pages-long report of suppression of natural treatments and it's in the congressional record. Now, did anybody ever do anything about this? No. And part of what he says in that report is that the collusion, the actual conspiracy, is between Los Federales at FDA, the patent medicine companies, and the AMA. That's where the conspiracy that Fitzgerald identifies is.
The Fitzgerald Report of 1953, which concluded there was an active conspiracy to suppress natural cancer treatments in the U.S., was initiated due to the suppression of Laetrile. More suppression of Laetrile followed over the next couple of decades.
First of all, you know, what is Laetrile? Laetrile is also called amygdalin and vitamin B17, and there are actually has been investigation showing that it has some benefit to the use of treatment of cancer, and it may be because cyanide is a component of Laetrile, and may also be a nutritional deficiency that provides some benefits that or nutrients that the body needs to fight these malignancies. But anyway, there was a Japanese researcher at Sloan Kettering who was studying this, and Dr. Ralph Moss was an investigative journalist there at the time, and started covering it, and he appeared to have beneficial results, but then for some unbeknownst reason, the information was suppressed, and that information was not allowed to be disseminated. And Dr. Moss wrote extensively about it. But about it was mid-1970s, and I'm not sure how beneficial Laetrile is. I have no experience with it, but it is an interesting example of how this type of these alternative approaches are routinely suppressed when they're opposed to the traditional and conventional approaches, because there's such a significant amount of funding that's involved. The big agencies, the FDA, of course, the AMA, and American Cancer Society, which are all in some way influenced by the drug cartels, are, and they're funded to oppose these and essentially classify them as quackery. And it's a common strategy that's used for many alternative treatments, and Laetrile being one of the earlier ones where they targeted, but there's dozens and dozens since then.
There is merciless harassment by the authorities of doctors who are inventors. I'm now going through 3 years of harassment by Texas Medical Board, and one of the reasons why I'm going through this is I use the treatment which is not standard treatment for pancreatic cancer. I use this for the type of incurable lung cancer, like malignant mesothelioma. This patient is also surviving now 5 years, okay? He will be dead a long time ago. These results were evaluated by outside oncologists, amazing results, okay? And I am being harassed because Texas Board is saying, you use the treatment which is not standard.
If you do the standard of care and you give chemo and people die, it's okay. If you don't do the standard of care and people live, that's not okay. It's politically incorrect. So this is the amazing thing. You take a poison, you give it to people, they die. It's part and parcel of the normal status quo, modus operandi. This is how it's supposed to be. Now you break that, you actually do something that's not toxic, you help patients, they live. Hey, we don't care whether the patient lives or not. That's irrelevant. It's not part of the standard of care.
The risk of a prison, risk of the jail, and the persecution, it is unbelievable. They try to shut me down in any way. Yes, because, you know, tell me one big revolutionary discovery that was not shut down. Tell me one. There is no chance, no possibility to escape. Because when you see something that is very, very new and people are in... cannot think about it, you are persecuted because you destabilize all the system. So any big, true discovery make the old system useless. That's why you are shut down. Because we live in a medieval status. This is the real reason why cancer is still killing millions of people.
So it's not easy to treat these advanced patients because we are continuously being harassed for doing this, okay? Which is incredible. We should be awarded. We should be set up the example. We are saving the lives of people who are sentenced to die. No, we are mercilessly harassed by lawyers, by people who know nothing about treatment, who are stupid puppets of the guys behind who knows very well what we can offer, but are directing these guys like in Nazi Germany, and they are simply obeying orders because they were programmed this way, okay? I think there'll be a time when there'll be some type of Nuremberg trial. So all of this white collar, nicely dressed lawyers and clerks who are chewing the money of taxpayers, they'll be held accountable for what they do, because many people died because of their actions, okay? And they do it secretly. They are not exposed. They feel that they are beyond any punishment, and they can continue to do this type of work.
If you look at someone who has cancer, you've had for a long time in Europe this notion that if you're using a natural approach, you run the risk as a doctor of having your license revoked. If you're a non-medical practitioner, you can be, you know, basically put into jail. There's the Cancer Act 1939 in the UK to deal with you. And this is utterly wrong, because an individual that has cancer is just another individual whose body needs nourishment and support more than a person who is healthy. And yet, to have that denied to those individuals is a real loss of fundamental rights and freedoms, and that needs to be changed.
It's a crime.
It is a crime, indeed.
The people need to be awakened, because obviously this is killing people.
If you withhold treatment that can save someone's life, isn't that the same thing as murder? I would have to agree with Dr. Brzezinski and Dr. Verkerk. But this is not the only time that the medical industry has been guilty of conspiracy against natural physicians.
In 1987, four chiropractors from Illinois, particularly Chester Wilk, he was the head chiropractor that took the AMA to court. They actually took the entire American Medical Association to court, accusing them of having a branch within their organization designed to eliminate chiropractic as a profession, a licensed profession they were trying to eliminate through the use of propaganda. Well, a federal district court judge in Illinois, Susan Getzendanner, in 1987, found the AMA guilty of conspiracy. That was the judgment. So if anybody tells you when you're talking about these things, oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist, you can lead them straight to the Wilk versus the AMA court ruling of 1987. And the judgment was guilty of conspiracy.
Are you beginning to get the picture here? This is not conspiracy theory. This is conspiracy fact, according to the courts. Now, why are we sharing this with you? Because you must understand the belly of this beast if you're going to believe the truth.
One of the many victims of this conspiracy to suppress natural cancer treatments is a man named Jason Vail. Last year, I had the privilege of interviewing him, and he shared with me the true story of how he was arrested, convicted, and spent 5 years in federal prison, not for murder or rape or assault, but for selling an unapproved cancer treatment, namely apricot seeds, which contain Laetril, on his website.
But Jason is not alone. Almost 80 years ago, a scientist named Royal Raymond Rife faced jail time for using an unapproved treatment.
In the 1930s, Royal Rife, who Dr. Royal Rife, who was a microbiologist, knew that there were microbes inside the cancer cells. And he came up with an electromedicine device, a couple of them actually, which was designed to do nothing but kill the microbes inside the cancer cells.
He did something very smart. Taking from Einstein the cue that everything has its own vibratory frequency, molecules do, people do, everything has its vibratory frequency. He determined the vibratory frequency of those microorganisms, and then he sent in a beam, which is why the machine was called a beam ray, he sent in a beam that had a dissonant frequency. What's that? You ever try to tune your radio, and you tune it just right, and it's nice and clear, still clear, but you go a little bit off, and it's bam, 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 in addition to the talk. That's dissonance. You're almost on the right frequency, but not quite. So he sends in a dissonant frequency that's almost what these bacteria do, but they can't stand that because they're vibrating at a really close... And so they rupture and die, all the bacteria do. He beamed them, all right? And the cancers were cured. Now, it's more complicated than that. He had to follow certain doses of rays and certain days and so forth. But anyway, the cancers were cured. It was celebrated in Los Angeles time. Okay. He reports that he was visited by two people, one being Morris Fishbein at the AMA, who was president at the time, and another person. And I believe him because I have read that same report in a doctor's book from Alabama, who is curing cancer with intravenous hydrochloric acid. I'm not kidding you. It was published for 3 years. I've got all of his reports. He was visited by two men from the AMA saying that he should sell them his treatments or he would never be published again. And he refused to sell. And he was never published again. I had the 3 years' worth of reports. I can't get any more. There weren't any more. Rife had the same visitation, and so did other cancer-treating practitioners. Visitations from AMA said, telling us, you sell us your stuff, or we'll do you.
So he developed this technology. The American Medical Association tried to buy him out, and he refused because he did not trust them. Good for him. And so the Food and Drug Administration went down and destroyed his laboratory, his equipment, destroyed all of his inventory.
In the end, Dr. Rife's lab was burned, his records were stolen, his life was ruined, and he eventually died of a drug overdose. Harry Hoxsey is another example of a man who was treating and curing cancer naturally that was heavily persecuted. Now, this is a story that is near and dear to my heart because in 1996, when my father, Graham Bollinger, was diagnosed with stomach cancer, we were doing everything that we possibly could to take him to what's called the Hoxsey Clinic in Tijuana, Mexico. Unfortunately, Dad died before we could get him to the Hoxsey Clinic, which is now called the Biomedical Center. That's why it was so exciting to me and the Truth About Cancer team to travel to Tijuana, Mexico and visit the Biomedical Center to learn more about Harry Hoxsey's treatment, which is still being used there. It's called the Hoxsey Tonic, and the rest of that protocol. Another exciting thing for me personally was to be able to meet Liz Jonas. Now, Liz Jonas is the sister of Mildred Nelson, and Mildred Nelson was Harry Hoxsey's chief nurse.
I'm Liz Jonas, and my sister was Mildred Nelson. I have no medical background. Mine is business. Mildred was the medical one in our family. My mom had cancer, ovarian and uterus, and they had planted radiation in her body and burned her very bad and then told her to go home and die. My dad heard about Harry Hoxsey, who was in Dallas, Texas, and we lived in Jacksboro, which is about 90 miles. So my dad called my sister. She was the oldest in our family. There were seven of us. And asked her to come drive for him. He was an old-timey rancher. And she said, what are you going to Dallas for? She said, to get parts for the tractor. And he said, no, I'm taking your mother to the doctor. So she came and drove. And through the day, Hoxsey found out she was a nurse and offered her a job. And my dad told him, no, she doesn't want to work for you. She thinks you're a quack. Okay. He offered for her to go look in all his files, but she didn't. And she couldn't talk my mother and daddy out of this, so she decided to go to work for him to prove he was a quack and to save her mom. Our mom lived to be 99 years old.
What a great story. Liz's sister, Mildred Nelson, wanted to prove that Harry Hoxsey was a quack, but she ended up becoming his chief nurse, and their mom lived to be 99 years old. Now, the head of the AMA at that time was Morris Fishbein. Now, he was the same man that was the head of the AMA when Royal Raymond Rife was destroyed. And the AMA wanted to buy out the Hoxsey formula. They almost signed the paperwork, but
they got to the point of signing the papers, and he said, you have to make this available to everybody. And they said, we may not make it available to anybody. We may not use it even. And he said, no, then I won't sell it.
So they basically wanted to buy it and bury it.
Bury it, yes.
Harry was arrested numerous times.
Numerous.
For what were the charges?
All different kinds, just whatever they came up with, you know. But the patients, sometimes he always carried a roll of bills in his pocket with him, a big roll of bills. And he made his money, in my understanding, in penny stock, all penny stock. But he carried a big roll of bills with him, and sometimes he'd bail himself out. Sometimes he'd just stay in jail. The patients would come and bring food, and they would circle the whole block. So they would just let him out to get rid of the patient.
Wow.
You know.
If that's not a testimony to Harry and the treatment, then nothing is. So the patients would surround the jail.
Yes.
Okay.
Surround the jail. Can you imagine?
No, I can't. I mean, not today.
Yeah.
But this was back when? 40s, 50s?
In the 40s.
40s. Okay.
But his patients were very loyal to him because the MAA and FDA, if they would find out they were going to mail medicine to a patient, and they would be standing at the patient's door and take the medicine so the patients couldn't have it. When Mildred moved the clinic to Mexico, he told her, he said, you have to drop the Hoxsey name. And she said, I can't do that. And he said, Joe, you have to. That's what they're after. They're mad at me. They're after me. So that's where the biomedical came in. But then the patients wouldn't drop it. We're still known as the Hoxie Clinic. And that's what we're put on this earth for.
It is.
Really. If you really stop and think about it, we're supposed to help each other.
That's right.
I have to agree with Liz. I mean, one of the main reasons that we're put here on earth is to help other people. And I commend her and the doctors there at the Hoxie Clinic, the biomedical center, for doing this. And one of the doctors there at the biomedical center that we interviewed was Dr. Elias Gutierrez. Here's some of his interview.
And basically what everything spins around, it's what is known as the Hoxie formula. It's a liquid made with a combination of several herbs and minerals, and it because of the way that it's put together, it selectively targets only the malignant cells. Any cell with a bad DNA or a bad metabolism, those are the ones that are going to be destroyed. Okay. Of course, there's a few vitamins, there's a diet, which is not a difficult one to follow, and we also use a lot of herbal, both Occidental and Chinese herbal formulas.
The formula that you're using, is this pretty much the same formula that Harry Hoxie used?
Exactly the same.
80, 100 years
exactly
ago?
Exactly the same. It was passed down from Hoxie over to Mildred, and then Mildred brought it into the clinic, and then she passed it on to Liz, she's the owner now, she's Mildred's sister, and we still use basically exactly the same formula as it was being used in Texas.
So if somebody comes into the Hoxie Clinic here and they want treatment, how long does the treatment typically last?
This is a clinic that does something in a different way that most of the regular clinics. We try to do everything on a single day. People come in the morning, they get registered, they go through the laboratory, they go through the x-rays, they get their consultation, a very thorough physical examination, and then we have to wait until we get the reports from laboratory x-rays, which takes a couple of hours, and then we call people up for a second visit in the afternoon, and we explain all the findings to them. We give them their instructive, their treatments, and they just pick up their supplies and make the payments and go home. Same day. This is something you can do at home. You don't have to be necessarily hospitalized to do it, you know? Mm-hmm. And they stay on the diet, and they come back for a checkup every 6 months, every year. Eventually, just come back every 2-3 years.
Mm, okay. Being a one-day treatment, the Hoxie treatment, relatively affordable?
I think so. Yeah. I think we're the cheapest clinic in town.
Are you really?
Oh, yeah.
8.5 years ago, back in August of 2006, I couldn't lay down. Matter of fact, Zach was with me on a motor car trip on the railroad, and the seatbelt started hurting on the way back from the trip. We were in about 300 miles, and the seatbelt started feeling tight. And the next week, I had another trip, and coming back, the seatbelt was also tight. And shortly after that, it couldn't lay down. And went to Mayo Clinic and was diagnosed, and the first time they said I didn't have cancer. And in a two-week period, they found out I did have cancer pretty bad, and it was in my non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It had it in the esophagus, the liver, the kidney, the lymph nodes all over under the arm and in the groin. I had a tumor bigger than a volleyball in the stomach, and then in the bone, stage 4. And the doctor gave me 3 days to 3 months, and one doctor says, you know, the last guy we treated like you made it 3 days. So it was not a very good forecast. So the day I found out that they had it in the bones, I found out at 2 o'clock up in the 10th floor of the Rochester Mayo Clinic at the Ghana building. Things looked very bleak, but on the way from left to Rochester, for instance, we had to be a flight in Minneapolis at 4 o'clock that day and didn't find out until after 2. And we made the plane by 13 minutes to get down here. And it's just there's no chance of living afterwards. And then, but here it's been 8.5 years later, and they've not had cancer for 8 years and 3 months. They haven't found it. Mayo Clinic couldn't find it. They haven't found it here. There's no cancer that's visible anymore. It started with Mayo Clinic. I had 13 doctors at Mayo Clinic, and they gave me the same forecast of 3 days to 3 months. And then it went up to the University of Minnesota, and then the Fairview Hospital and the Masonic Cancer Center. I received a death sentence from 17 doctors, and the 18th one was down here, Dr. Gutierrez, and it was no big deal to him. It was bad, yes, but nothing special. And as far as I know, I was taking more medicine and more tonic than any other patient I ever talked to so far. I talked to a lot of patients from down here that I've sent down here and other patients, but I was taking the strongest dose they had, but I never missed a day of work. And so it never affected my ability to do whatever, but it made the total difference in life.
This life is fantastic. I mean, I got a grandson, I got three grandsons, but the only one that can come with me once in a while. The other two are very busy. And this one here gets to come with me. We do a lot of things together, including come down for Jeep rides and stuff. We would have never been able to have that if we wouldn't have been here to find, get some help, a lot of help. Life is great. Life is great.
What an encouraging story from Dave, who has been cancer-free now for 8 years due to the Hoxie formula, and who was told by 17 traditional doctors that he had no hope and that even the toxic chemo drugs couldn't save him.
I want to be clear. We are not saying that everyone that works in the medical industry, the cancer industry, or the pharmaceutical companies are bad people. Not at all. That is not what we're trying to say. There are a lot of good people that are working in the medical industry, the cancer industry, and for those alphabet agencies, even the FDA. So we're not criticizing everybody that works for those agencies. What we are saying in this documentary, and we're trying to communicate this fact, is that the entire medical system has been hijacked. If a plane is hijacked, it is not the pilot's fault that it's hijacked. In the same manner, the fact that the medical industry has been hijacked, it's not your doctor's fault that that's happened. The fact that the pharmaceutical companies, their sole purpose is to make money, that's not the fault of any person that works for the pharmaceutical companies, the sales reps and the other people that work for those companies. It's not their fault. We want to be clear that we communicate that. The problem is that the system is broken. Money is driving the decisions of the people that are the leaders in those industries and not the health of the people that take their products. The number one goal for big pharmaceutical companies, at least, is shareholder profits. They are publicly traded companies, and the bottom line is their bottom line. Over the course of our travels, we were privileged to meet a couple of people that had previously worked for pharmaceutical companies, but once they realized that the number one driving force behind those decisions in big pharma is making money and not necessarily getting people healthy, both of them got out to their credit.
I would hear a lot in our meetings, and the town hall meetings, that it was all about making the shareholders happy.
Really?
And I'm like, you know what? I don't want to make the shareholders happy. You know, that's not the point of what we are doing. We want to be able to solve bigger problems than to see how much money goes into the shareholders' pockets.
In 2011, I just kind of by chance found a documentary, and the title caught my eye. It was called Dying to Have Known. And it was one of the documentaries about the Gerson therapy.
Okay.
And I remember watching it. It was almost stages, you know, when I was watching the video. First, it was, what in the world are they talking about? And they were talking about people that had late stage cancer and they had somewhere to go, mm-hmm. and they were surviving. And I'm like, I've never heard of this. So I keep watching. And as a pharmaceutical representative, the doctors teach us very well that we practice evidence-based medicine.
Right.
Evidence-based medicine. So I'm watching and I'm thinking, this all sounds really good, but I wonder what kind of evidence they have, you know? So
right.
They switch to the physician, and I believe it's China that is doing the Gerson therapy. And I just remember him sitting in front of this huge filing cabinet. And the person that was interviewing, he said, just pick files. And he just started opening these drawers of all these files of patients, all this evidence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
All this evidence, right? So I'm going, wow, how is this possible? There's evidence. Then the documentary goes on to talk about Max Gerson.
Right.
The way that the therapies were suppressed.
Mm.
And that, you know, of course, I remember sitting up on the couch, on the edge of the couch, like, yeah, it was like the Band-Aid being ripped off, that moment of just disbelief. My
right.
whole life, my mother's a nurse. I mean, we grew up at the doctor's office and at the nursing home, and I had no idea. I worked in the hospital. I was a phlebotomist. I worked in the lab. You know, my whole life was medicine.
Right.
And so it was just shocking in a really impactful way immediately. Mm. Immediately, it changed my life. So I wanted to research, but I really thought that my research would disprove it. You know, I thought, this is really awesome, but I just, you know, it's hard to believe, you know. So I started researching, and I felt really strange. Like, you know, I felt like I was alone, and I go to work every day in this industry, and I'm thinking, do they know this? You know, do they know what I know?
Now, to her credit, Tara Mann used to make a ton of money working for big pharmaceutical companies. But once she realized that they weren't healing people, that they were actually harming people, she got out, and then she and her husband, Steve, began a nonprofit called Cancer Crackdown. And that's one of the charities that we at The Truth About Cancer are happy to donate to. Now, Tara just mentioned the Gerson therapy. We will learn a lot more about the Gerson therapy in episode 8, so be sure that you tune in for that one. But in the meantime, we're about to hear some telling quotes from doctors about the absurdity and the arrogance of trying to force treatments on people against their will.
If I tell you, you have to do this, which is very typical of conventional medicine, you have to do this, that there's a degree of arrogance in that statement. This is what you need. Given the complexity of the human experience, for me to presume that I know what you need, that is a tremendous arrogance. That's common in medicine, it's very common. This is what you need to do. And if you don't do it, I'll force you. I'll have somebody force you, because that happens. We know that.
Yeah.
We know that when somebody doesn't choose for their kids the exact path, oh, we'll have somebody enforcing that so that they choose that, because that's what they need. Oh my God, what arrogance. What a humongous arrogance.
It was best called by John Rappaport scientific totalitarianism. I think it's a great term for it. Some people call it medical fascism. It means that the so-called science, which is really just corporate-driven fraudulent science, but the so-called science-driven medicine is being forced upon you now in absolute violation of the American Medical Association's Code of Medical Ethics, which says that the patient must be given the choice, the patient must be informed. You know, they talk about informed consent. This is supposed to be a pillar of the ethical practice of medicine in the United States of America and really all around the world. That is now being stripped away, where parents are being told you must submit your children to these interventions, whether you like it or not. That's a violation at every level of human rights, of human dignity, of parental rights.
Parents need to know and they need to prepare.
Yeah.
Because if you're in a situation as a parent and your child is diagnosed and you don't want them to have chemotherapy, you need to prepare to run, you know?
Yeah.
Because if not, they are going to come take your kids.
Wow, was Chris Wark exaggerating? Will the government really come and take your children?
I'm a pharmacist by my profession, so I have been practicing that for about 20 years. So when my daughter was diagnosed, about 3 years ago, we decided, you know, the whole treatment was just huge and barbaric, and it's just, and the options was just very limited, and we. I think I ran that by you at that time. There was just the prognosis was less than 20%. Amputation was almost definite. When the swelling happened, that's where mistake number one. We went to the emergency room. At that point, I thought, well, look, they didn't have two significant successes with that. And I thought that, you know, on an ethical standpoint, if you don't have very much, you shouldn't be doing that much. Mm-hmm. And that's what I thought. I didn't think that they would pursue such a, you know, aggressive means to get it. And at that point, the doctor was, again, depending on who you get, we had a physician that was very stubborn, believed in, thinks that he has all the answers, didn't know anything about what we were approaching.
They kept Selena.
Oh, yeah. Selena with guard. They had armed guards at that point because they knew where my mind was at.
They had armed guards at her room.
On her room. They knew where my mind was at because my mind was to take her back to the facility of my choice.
Right.
And the facility that would, you know, give her a chance at some sort of a normal life. They came with their lawyers and they said that if you don't sign consent, we're going to take custody of the child. You're going to lose custody of the child. Ultimately, the judge said, you're not an expert. He is, right? The oncologist, he's the expert. So there's nothing he can do, and the custody was given to the state, and then
took custody of Selena.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and then they started aggressive chemotherapy at that point. This is documented. So they knew that, but they continued with the chemo, and I think that any adult would have been just saying, hey, look at my arm is deteriorating. Every dose you give, my arm is opening up, like it's just opening up, and the wound is getting bigger. And I pleaded with the physician. I have no way to even getting second opinions at that point because the state's got custody. Mm. So nor can I go to a physician and say, this is wrong. You got to take a look at it, because they wouldn't approach us because we don't have custody. Right. You're not the legal custodian.
You don't have custody of your own child.
Child, correct.
The state of Illinois did.
State of Illinois. So I pleaded with him. I said, the arm's not going to stand. It's not going to make it. I, you know, this is all I could do. There's nothing. And every time, about eight white coats come into the room, look at our wound getting bigger and bigger with every dose. As much as I pleaded, and as much as I saw, the wound got so big, got infected with MRSA. They're doing all these cultures at that point. The wound, if you see it, is horrific. It's so graphic. You will not believe that's a human arm, the way that it deteriorated over time. It was just incredible. It was graphic for her. That's post-traumatic stress for her. For us, certainly it is. Sure. Then in the end, an amputation was required. Now, after that point, we still didn't have custody after the amputation for another 6 months. We have custody now.
Okay.
We have custody now. I mean, we had the best insurance, and I think really it's the worst thing you can have. We had the best insurance. To have best insurance means every drug that is covered will be used and was used. Every drug that wasn't covered, I mean, he would have used Avastin. Avastin is another $400,000 drug. He would have used it if it was covered. But ultimately, I was in a position where I could have dropped her from my insurance. The state didn't pay for it. All this $2.2 million was paid out to the hospitals. And it was all paid from my insurance.
It's something where everything just blurs, your energy just leaves your body, you're in shock, it's traumatic, and you just look at each other and you don't know what to say.
Yeah.
I even called my boss. I was supposed to be at a trade show and I was bawling. I said, man, we just got some bad news. Mm. But after the first month, and I shared this with you too, we made a decision that we wanted to, since the cancer was so far down and in remission, as they say, and they told us themselves, that we were like, okay, you know what? Thank you for your business. We're good now. We're going to go ahead and build her up naturally now that the cancer and half of her, you know, system has been, you know, chemoed, chemically cleansed. We're going to go in and put in the natural good stuff now and see how we can get her to respond there. Well, the hospital didn't like that. When that happened, it wasn't 3 days later, and there was that very, very, very loud, aggressive knock at our door. I'm thinking, that doesn't sound like anybody I know. Nobody knocks like that. Almost sounded like a boot. So I went to the door, and it was the Office of Child Services, and they came. And they said, look, the hospital called. You have taken your child out of treatment, and you need to bring your child right back to treatment. I'm like, well, we're finished with that treatment. We're just going to continue on with another treatment, right? I'm the parents. I even looked up the Alaska statutes. Parents have the legal right to decide how their children get treated. And what I didn't know is it doesn't matter what the statutes say. And the administrative truth about that is that the child is a ward of the state.
The Department of Children and Families was called because we were wasting time, according to the doctors. They wanted me in for chemotherapy a week after my biopsy was done at Hartford. And they came in and they took me because they said that I had to get the chemo. And
what do you mean they said that when you say they took you?
They came into my house in October around Halloween and they said that I had to go with them.
And who is they?
The DCF workers.
Okay. So they actually came into your home and took you from your...
Yeah, they had about 12 police squad cars surrounding my house and the block, and they basically just came into my house and said, we have to go. My mom wasn't even home. I was hiding in my closet upstairs because I had no idea what was going on, and...
Were you the only one at the house?
Yeah. I called my mom crying, and she came home immediately to police and DCF workers surrounding our house. after about 2 weeks of being in the hospital, going through courts and judges, they got the order that they could force me to do the chemotherapy. And at that point, I was in the hospital. I couldn't leave my room. There was a guard sitting outside of my door. I couldn't use my phone. I couldn't contact my mom. And basically, it came down to one morning they came in and they strapped me to the bed and they sedated me for surgery.
Really?
Yes. Because you have to have a port to have chemotherapy, which is why I have a scar.
And you didn't want a port?
No, because I didn't want the chemo. They came in to insert an IV and I said no. So they had to have the officers and the security guards and the staff come in, and they brought in a bed that had straps, and they had to tie me down by my wrists and my ankles. And a woman came in and they put a needle in my neck to knock me out. And the next thing I knew, I woke up and I was in the recovery room.
Well, I would like to know, how is that any different from Nazi Germany, when people were put into concentration camps and experimented on, or forced to do certain things? I don't know what the difference is, because we live in the United States, the land of the free, the home of the brave, so that makes it different. I mean, it's amazing to me that the entire population of the United States doesn't know about this. And the reason they don't know about it is because it's shushed up by the media. Nobody wants to talk about it. But this is no different than what was done in Germany, or the when people are basically raped and pillaged. This, to me, that's the same thing.
This is unacceptable. This is incompatible with a free society. And frankly, the doctors that engage in that kind of activity, and the hospital staff that strap people down and force chemotherapy into these children, they should be arrested. They should go to jail, just like this other oncology doctor who's serving 50 or 45 years in prison now.
When a people allow a government to dictate the foods they put in their mouth and the medicines to take into their bodies, their souls will soon be in the same sorry state as those who are ruled by tyranny. And as much as I would like to take credit for that phrase, that was uttered by Thomas Jefferson over 250 years ago.
We talked about concentration camps. They are surrounded by a fence. If someone tries to escape the fences of the modern concentration camp, the ones that confine the cancer patient within the perimeter of conventional thinking, of chemotherapy thinking, they are being haunted. How many court cases have been filed around the world for withdrawing custody of parents who went into natural health, as opposed to staying within the confines, within the fences of conventional chemotherapy treatments? It's nothing else. The dimension of a child dying in a concentration camp or dying from leukemia that is being intoxicated by chemotherapy, as opposed to choosing natural paths, are the same. The parents are losing a child. The family is losing their future. And that's the deeper dimension of what we're talking about. That the same interest groups that have proven again and again in the past, namely the pharmaceutical investment business, how ruthless they are still around, trying to fool us, trying to tell us, well, believe us. Why should we? If we don't have the courage to liberate ourselves, then we will not make progress. Among all diseases, the one disease that the status quo, meaning the pharmaceutical investment business, needs most to continue its business, to stabilize, to cement its system, is cancer. They can afford to allow, let's say, advances in osteoporosis that decrease the number of bone fractures without major damage to its future existence. They can allow a progress in this and that diseases to kind of mask their principal business, but they cannot allow cancer to disappear or being identified as a disease that can be regulated or prevented. So long ago, they have initiated what Dr. Natsuki mentioned, the fact of fear. In fact, it's more than that. It's a psychological warfare on humanity that the pharmaceutical industry is leading with the tool cancer. Keeping cancer as a death verdict is the platform, is a precondition for this entire investment industry to continue.
Wow, Big Pharma may need this cancer investment industry to continue so that the money keeps flowing in. But our goal with The Truth About Cancer is exactly the opposite. We want to eradicate cancer once and for all. And that's why we've shared these truths with you today. Maybe they've been a little bit difficult to believe, but they are the truth. Has your perspective changed on this? I hope that it has, because the perspective that most people have when they hear cancer is that cancer is a death sentence. And our message is exactly the opposite. Cancer is not a death sentence. There is always hope.
My name is Pamela Kelsey. I was diagnosed with cancer of the pancreas in 1975. I was told that I had a year and a half to live at the most. If I did chemotherapy, possibly chemotherapy, radiology, the different treatments that conventional medicine has. I chose not to do that after finding out about the clinic in Mexico and chose to go on their regimen. Thought my life was over, but it was too soon to be over. I was only 34 years old, and my husband and I had started a business called Leading Estates of the World. We traveled the world. We saw the most beautiful properties all over the world and enjoyed the business very much. I wrote and designed for the magazine, and we were in a very happy relationship, and I just wanted a solution. I was always proactive to trying to, if there's a problem, I'm going to fix it. And so a friend of mine, I had this horrible pain, just terrible, terrible pain. I was in bed for about, off and on for about a year with low blood sugar, abdominal pain, and then it got worse and worse to the point where I felt like I had a knife through the middle of my chest and it helped my back. And so a friend said, I know a friend who was cured. She had inoperable cancer of the colon, and she went to a clinic in Mexico, and she's 5 years clear of cancer. So my husband and I didn't waste any time. We came right down to Mexico, and we had the went through the physical, and I was still very nervous about everything, but we talked to patients down here. There must have been 40 patients down here with similar stories. So I began to gain hope and confidence that this was something that would really work. And so I took the medicine home, the tonic and the supplements. I was very diligent, religiously so, about sticking to the diet, doing everything the doctors told me. And within a year, well, they had told me that within 3 months I would start to feel better. And so it was almost 3 months to the day that I was able to start not having so much pain. My migraine headaches were not so frequent, not so intense. And I gradually stopped, I gradually, month by month, stopped having the pain in my abdomen. I could start digesting my food, and I got better. And within a year, I was clear of cancer of the pancreas. And it was just so amazing because I knew that very few people survive cancer of the pancreas. And over the years, of course, since then, I don't know of anyone that survived as long as I have. And then we had another episode in our life, because in 2011, I came to the clinic. I'd been under a great deal of stress. We'd had a lot of situations that were challenging. And so I came to the clinic for a physical. And I didn't expect anything bad, but I just wanted to come and have the doctor help me with some of the stresses, and I wasn't reacting very well to stress. So we went to St. John's Hospital. They did a CT scan, and they detected lesions in the liver up to 3.9 centimeters. They were hypoechoic, which meant that, and they said, so liver neoplasm cannot be excluded, and that meant that, as I was told, that the density of the tissue was so dense that that's what is normally from cancer. So I immediately came down to the clinic then and had another CAT scan, and that confirmed that I did have cancer. I had 22 focal lesions on the liver, and they put me on the treatment. I felt like I'd been totally blindsided because I'd been free for decades of cancer. And here I had this terrible diagnosis, and it was so surprising to me. Pancreatic cancer was much more painful. This was very subtle. It was just you know, this full feeling in my body and a little bit of pain. They asked me to come back in 3 months, so I couldn't wait 3 months. I was wanting to come back sooner and see what was happening. So I came back in 2.5 months, and all but three of the lesions were gone. And it was an unbelievable feeling. It was just so unbelievable that here, 50%, they said, of my liver had been affected by all the lesions on the liver. So 50% of my liver was bad and had cancer. And here I had only three small spots remaining. And then within a few, the next physical, very shortly after that, showed that there was no more cancer. I'm the longest, to my knowledge, the longest living cancer survivor of the pancreas, and I'm alive and well 40 years later. The doctors have confirmed that there is no longer any trace of cancer in my body, and I'm just radiant with happiness because I know that this treatment works, and I know that had I done the conventional treatment, I wouldn't have lived. We just, you know, Bob and I just owe my life to you and to your sister, and yet you've carried on. Mildred, it was her life work. She was totally devoted. She moved from Dallas to here, went through. She could have had a totally different life, but she was so committed.
Here's a summary of what you've come to understand during this episode. You've seen the heartbreaking truth behind why cancer is so rapidly spreading and why the false cures have been perpetuated. I hope this side of the history equation has helped you understand the foundation for why things are the way they are. You've seen the shocking decisions concerning the Nuremberg trials, where the vilest of crimes were praised, and that evil intent opened a floodgate of deception that led to the creation of a system that sought not to eradicate disease, but rather amplify it through disseminating false solutions for the sake of perpetual monetary gain. You've seen the doctors who, rather than being praised or awarded for their heroic deeds in healing their patients, have been persecuted, slandered, threatened, and in some cases have even had their patient records destroyed, their practice shut down, they've been imprisoned, even run out of the country, and have had their families undergo harassment and heartache for their loyalty to the cause. You've seen the children that have been forced chemotherapy against their wishes and their parents' wishes, regardless of their level of expertise or the effectiveness of their desired natural proven protocol. You've seen the proof that corruption, greed, coercion, deception, and fear have been tools employed to create a system that leaves people confused and afraid rather than empowered. The great news today is that we have won the battle in your life, as you have discovered the truth. And as it said, the truth will set you free. I'm so happy that you've experienced this and that through you, your loved ones too will know the truth about cancer. I know you felt the hope and courage in the stories of the survivors that have recovered taking a natural approach, achieving feats unheard of by conventional methods of treatment. Isn't it wonderful to see real life proof? It warms my heart to see lives restored. I hope that you've enjoyed learning these things, and while they may be difficult to hear, it does bring us to the central truth that cancer is in fact not a death sentence. In light of this truth that we have established, you can give yourself one of the greatest gifts in this moment, and that is the peace that results when you are free from fear. You do not have to live in fear. You can prevent and beat cancer 100% naturally.
Wow, that's a lot of information that we covered tonight. I hope that you've learned a lot from it. I know that I actually learned a lot traveling and getting this information for you. And this information, these truths that we've shared tonight, are fundamental in the rest of our journey these next 8 days. I can't wait for the next episode, folks. We're gonna travel all the way down to Australia, and we're gonna learn from a practitioner and a couple of cancer survivors what they have done to treat cancer naturally. We're gonna learn about essential oils and the role that they play, not only in preventing, but also in treating cancer. We're gonna also discover some interesting knowledge about hormones and the role that they play in diagnosis and prevention and even treatment of cancer. But the biggie in the next episode is breast cancer. This is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and there are a lot of lies and deceptions that are associated with treatment and diagnosing breast cancer. And there's a lot of truths that are not commonly known. We're going to discover all of those in the next episode. I'm really pumped about it, and I hope that you join us there. I thank you for watching tonight's episode, and I can't wait to see you for the next one. In the meantime, get some rest, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in tonight. God bless all of you.
it is extremely important to state the truth, to fight for the truth, and this is why we appreciate you coming to us and interviewing us at length on this process, because it is a courageous thing that you are doing, Ty, and not just with us, but with opening up this curtain of deception and lies about cancer and for that matter, other diseases, and giving the people of America and the world the chance to see through that maze of deception and make their own choice. I think it's you must be complimented. I'm complimenting you for that.
Thank you. To Ty and Chris and Bill Henderson, and I've watched all of Ty's documentary, the whole entire thing, several times, and continue to watch some of his excerpts from on Facebook when he'll bring some of those out every once in a while, Dr. Gonzalez, and a big thank you to each and every one of those doctors who participated, because they truly saved my life. And I think Dr. Bitar definitely is one of those. That this documentary, if I didn't have that, I wouldn't think I would have had another option. And so it's just a huge thank you. Thank you for doing what they're doing.
Hey, I'm most grateful not only for participating in this global quest, but that you all have been able to watch a great man, a tremendous healer, who has passed from this plane much too soon, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, a good friend, a dear friend of mine. And his legacy of healing, of empowering you to heal, of bringing that power to heal back where it belongs with you, will continue long after. But I continue every day that I breathe and speak and communicate through radio and through this global quest to acknowledge the great works of Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez and what he brought to us all, and a passion and a dedication to really learn and to teach about nutritional ways to prevent and reverse cancer, detoxification protocols. And I hope that he has inspired you as he has inspired me to continue to learn and never stop learning and never stop helping and never stop working to help others who are genuinely in need. And this is why we do what we do, and this is why the Global Quest is also greatly honoring and greatly appreciative of all the efforts of Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, and his works will not perish because of this and because of what you are doing and watching and supporting this global quest. Thank you, Dr. Nick. We love you. We appreciate you.
He supported us from the very beginning, and it means so much to have had his support, and it's the world is just missing a great star, and of course, heaven's gain or loss.
What did you think of this first show in the series? Did you learn something new? Are you excited to see the next 8 episodes? Do you think your friends and your family would enjoy watching it as well? Then help us spread the word by sharing this page on Facebook and on Twitter and on all the other social media sites by clicking the links below. Your support will make a huge difference in the number of people that we reach and ultimately in the number of lives that we save. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you tomorrow.